Gerontologist Nadine Roberts Cornish is an expert on the caregiver's experience. The author of Tears in My Gumbo and her new book, Prayers in My Gumbo, joins us to share her journey and her insights on caregiving. Nadine, why did you write these books?
Hello, Scott. I wrote the books because first and foremost, I was asked to write the books. The caregivers that I've been blessed to work with over the last decade have asked me to share their stories because I literally share my perspective of their stories with them. And so it was a direct ask from the caregivers that I've been blessed to work with over the past decade.
And, you know, early on in your book, you say that caregivers operate in the confluence of love and loss when they take on the care of their beloved. What did you mean by that?
So what I meant by that is that typically you are tasked with the experience and opportunity of having to care for someone that you love. And oftentimes it's a chronic illness. And what you watch during that time frame is the decline. And so what you're doing is you are lovingly caring for that person that you love, but you're also recognizing at the same time that you're losing that person. For example, if you're caring for someone with dementia, which is what I believe to be one of the greatest challenges in caring for a loved one, the person with dementia for a period of time is very cognizant and aware of what's going on. But as things start to change and they begin to decline, they lose their memory. They lose their ability to do the things that they used to do. And so consequently, that's a loss. And that's a grief that begins during the caregiving journey.
Now, this book, one person in this book who runs completely through it is your mother. Tell us about your mom and her impact, not only on you personally, but on your work.
So if it were not for my mother, I would not be in this line of work. I would not be doing this work. Mm-hmm. I often say that my caregiving journey with my mom would span the course of 15 years, really was my opportunity and my training ground for the work that I do today. My mother had a multitude of complex chronic illnesses, and most really found it phenomenal that one person could sustain and really still thrive in all that she was dealing and contending with. And throughout her journey, it was one thing after another, Scott. And it was one doctor, one specialist, one diagnosis after another. And my mother hung in there like a real trooper over a 15-year period. And I became her advocate. I became the researcher, the person responsible for figuring out what are they saying? What's the prognosis? What are the other options besides what it is that you're sharing with us? Because we really were fighting hard for my mother's quality of life. And for the most part, we were really victorious in achieving that. But it was a hard-fought battle, for sure.
Well, and there's a point in your book where you talk about that your mother, at somewhat pretty far in on that journey, came down with breast cancer, correct?
Absolutely. The last 6 months.
Stage 4.
Yes.
Stage 4. And that, even though you had been providing care for so long, through all the challenges that she had, something about that diagnosis and that new condition presenting itself really seemed to hit you for, or throw you for a loop. What happened there?
So my mother had been hospitalized that year 7 times for primarily for severe anemia. She was constantly having to go in for blood transfusions. And I was constantly asking, is there something else going on? We definitely have a strand of cancer that runs through our family. Does my mother have cancer? And they kept saying, no, she does not have cancer. And so in September of that year, when finally we actually observed a mass on her breast and took her in to have that biopsied, it was cancer and it was already stage 4. And that was particularly devastating because we had been so actively involved in her care, two doctor visits a month and 7 hospitalizations in the course of that year. And so it was pretty devastating to get that particular diagnosis, because at that point, my mother was no longer a candidate for chemo or radiation. She had already had as much as she could have. And so we literally had to simply live with the diagnosis and the prognosis.
You talk to, in the book, you use stories.
Absolutely.
The book in pursuit of explaining what you consider to be the five steps of conscious caregiving. Tell us about these five steps and what they mean to people as they go through them.
Well, Scott, in my own journey, I had to come to an understanding of the process and what I was going through during the process and retrospectively after my mother had transitioned. And literally, my mother probably had been gone maybe 30 days before when the phone started ringing. And it was other caregivers calling to ask questions, ask advice, ask for resources and information, because they knew that I had just really ended a very long journey. And I was surprised that it kind of lit up when the phone rang and when I got to support other people. And I found that it allowed me to continue to talk about my mother, which allowed me to keep her legacy very much alive. So that was the unexpected gift. And then the unexpected gift of really recognizing that with a public health background, and then with a very fresh experience of having supported my mother through her journey, I really was in a position to positively support and help other caregivers. And literally, I guess I took about another month and ultimately a year to just simply take care of myself and really decide how do I go about starting a business to support family caregivers. And from the very first caregiver that I supported, constantly I was asked to share their stories, because part of the therapeutic process of supporting the caregiver was reminding them of what they had successfully accomplished, reminding them constantly as even though you're challenged, you are doing well through this process. The five steps of conscious caregiving came in when I recognized that there was this pattern that was pretty continuous throughout, no matter who the caregiver I was working with and supporting. And so the five steps of caregiving starts with helplessness, the very first step. Most caregivers find themselves in a state of helplessness, not quite knowing what to do, where to go, or what's next, because in many instances, the journey is an unexpected one. The next step after helplessness is recognition that you don't know what you don't know. And when you realize you don't know what you don't know, you're much more receptive to just simply asking. I am in a state of not knowing about this particular, this entire process that's happening. I don't know it and I don't understand it. And I'm okay with that. I recognize that. Then we move to the next step, which is process. Process is all of the different stages and steps of understanding, learning what you need to learn, understanding that the importance of advocacy. And in addition to that, recognizing that even though you are very receptive to caring for the person that you need to care for, you also understand that your self-care must come first, right? And then understanding that a spiritual process is necessary in this journey as well. And from process, we go to acceptance, accepting that we are not in control, because we absolutely are not. And when we're caring for a loved one who's critically or chronically ill, we're not in control. And we have to accept that. And then surrendering to the inevitable, surrendering to the fact that this is not our will. This is not our doing. It just simply is. And we are at peace with that.
Interesting. You use gumbo as a sort of a metaphor for your journey. What is it about gumbo that speaks to you, that addresses this experience that you went through yourself, but you've shared with so many others?
So Scott, you got to know that gumbo is in my DNA. I'm from New Orleans, born and raised through and through. And gumbo was an integral part of my growing up. It's been an integral part of my adulthood. Every happy occasion, every celebration, every sad occasion, every major shift in my life, gumbo's been there. And the process of making gumbo is a terrific analogy to caregiving, in my opinion. Gumbo is this confluence of all of these incredible ingredients that you can't even fathom how all of this stuff comes together, and you're able to come up with a dish that's unlike any dish anywhere. People all over the world go to New Orleans for gumbo. And so gumbo made so much sense to me because just like the complexity of caregiving, there's this complexity in gumbo of all of these different ingredients and how you put it all together. And then there's the factor that gumbo is always best when it's created in community. You can do it by yourself. Just like caregiving, you can do it by yourself, but it's always best if it's done in community. Invite, allow others to participate in the process, because just as you as the primary caregiver needs the support, the care recipient needs the support of all of the other people that are in their lives to be a part of this process. And then ultimately, I'll say this really quickly, Scott, the foundation for gumbo that I make is love. And in caregiving, the foundation is absolutely love. It's why people do what they do. They make the sacrifices that they make because of the love.
In the difficult moments, you speak to in the book, Tears in My Gumbo, that you cannot outrun grief.
Yeah.
How is it that we as human beings attempt to deal with caregiving that sometimes ignores rational self-care and we end up hurting ourselves?
It's this idea that self-sacrifice is what's necessary in order to completely and unselfishly provide all that we have. And that really is an erroneous misperception around caring for a loved one. Really and truthfully, and I say it all the time, and I have a lot of stories in the book that stresses the importance of self-care over all care, because if the person who's providing the care fails to take care of themselves, ultimately somebody's going to have to step in and take care of the original care recipient, and now you're going to become the one in need of care because you didn't take care of yourself. You didn't make yourself the priority. So it really is, when I think about the 11 years now that I've been doing this work, Scott, I think it's the thing that makes me keep going when I get tired and when I think, well, maybe, you know, my time doing this work is up. The thing that makes me keep going is the fact that there are so many caregivers out there who need to be encouraged, who need to be taught how to make themselves the priority in the caregiving journey.
Interesting. I'm curious, we're talking about how to make oneself a priority during the caregiving journey. What are some of the biggest mistakes that we all tend to make when we become caregivers?
We forget that caregiving is what we do. It is not who we are. I think that's probably the biggest mistake. One of the stories that I talk about in Tears in My Gumbo is the sisters who were caring for each other. Right? They were up in age. They had made the decision in their late 70s that if anything happens to one or the other, one would take care of the other. And they put their affairs in order. They got an attorney. They had all of the paperwork taken care of. And when life happened, they were ready. They were so prepared, Scott, that literally they were taken to court by a family member, and the judge had to rule in the sister's favor because they had done their homework. They had put their affairs in order and seen to it that all of the I's were dotted and T's were crossed. And it was a beautiful thing to experience. But the self-care of they were twins, so I can't say of the older one, but the primary caregiver, her self-care was paramount. and she would not sacrifice her self-care. She was willing to bring in the additional support that was needed so that she could take care of her sister, but she would have help with caring for her sister. And she would have time during those times when the professional caregiver would come in, she would take off and she would spend time doing all of the things that she still loved to do. And it was just a beautiful thing to witness. And I use that example all the time, that self-sacrifice really is not the ticket. Too many caregivers, Scott, actually die before the person they're caring for. And it's the one thing that keeps me committed to doing this work, because I really am committed to seeing to it that caregivers thrive in this journey. There's so much joy. There are so many blessings that you receive as a result of making this commitment, and the expansion within yourself and who you are, who you become, because you said yes to this amazing experience is pretty, it's a pretty phenomenal experience. And, you know, I really encourage caregivers to make themselves a priority, because when they're able to do that, they're able to really experience the joy in the journey.
Well, you talk about opening oneself to the experience and experiencing that joy. At the same time, particularly in the story of the sisters, there was dissension within the family where they actually had to go to court and have it adjudicated. What advice would you give to us who may be the caregiver, and we have expectations that other members of the family were going to step up as well? And frankly, the reality doesn't meet the expectations, and we're all in it by ourselves.
Yeah. So I really talk about releasing the idea, right? The perfect idea. You have to release that, because you don't know how other people are going to respond. You don't know if they're going to show up, keep their word, and do what you think they ought to do under the circumstances. And so I always remind the primary caregiver of the assignment, and that for whatever reasons, you were the person who said yes to this particular assignment of being the primary caregiver. And it really is so much more healthful and helpful if you release the resentment that you might have, which is human and understandable, but release the person from the expectations that you have. And when you do that, what happens is that somehow the universe opens up the opportunity for other people that you never expected, people that you didn't even know, who will actually show up and be a really powerful influence and instrument in the caregiving journey, and a great support to you. Because, you know, for many reasons, there are many family members who should and don't. And what you have to do in the caregiving journey is simply bless and release that and move forward.
When the moment of life presents itself where we are going to have to start to assume greater responsibility for providing the care for a loved one, what types of resources should we be seeking, and where should we be going to find them?
So it first starts with whatever that diagnosis is. Like if you're just caring for an elderly loved one, AARP is a great resource for caregiving services that are available. If you're dealing with a loved one who has dementia of any form, Alzheimer's Association is the absolutely best resource. I don't care where you live. The Alzheimer's Association has a 24/7 helpline that's available across the country. You can call and you will speak to a professional who will support you and help you through whatever the challenge is, even if it's happening at 3 o'clock in the morning. Support groups are an amazing support for family caregivers. Since the pandemic, I have been supporting family caregivers Monday, 3 o'clock Mountain Standard Time via Zoom. Caregivers across the country hop on that call, and for an hour, they are supported, they are encouraged, they ask questions, and they share their experience so that they know that they're not alone. And it's always interesting listening to other caregivers, listening to their stories and hearing what they've gone through, because what those stories and experiences really help to inform you. And oftentimes it makes the caregiver feel better about their situation.
Well, you know, sometimes you feel like you're up against the world, and you spend a lot of time on issue advocacy, whether you're up against a healthcare system, an insurance company, the government. What are the core ingredients, to use your gumbo analogy, to successful advocacy?
So understanding, first of all, that advocacy is your right and it is your responsibility as you care for your loved one, number one. Number two is recognizing that most systems have a default of no. So no is typically the first answer that you're going to receive. I share with my clients to expect the no, to expect it, to welcome it, and to get ready for that all-important ingredient, which is appeal. Appeal is just a natural part of the process. No is the default. You prepare to appeal. You expect it. It's not a problem. You are going to complete the necessary paperwork. You're going to make the necessary phone call so that you can appeal the decision. You are your loved one's advocate. And I really invite people to enjoy the process, because it's not easy, and it's not designed for a smooth transition. It really is designed for stops and starts. And so if you realize that that's what's going to happen, then you're better prepared and more equipped to handle it.
So you wrote Tears in My Gumbo, and it's both story and guidebook for the journey. And then you wrote this new book, Prayers in My Gumbo.
Yes.
Really goes to another issue that seems very central to your work and your existence, and that's the issue of faith. What has faith meant for you in terms of your work and your own journey?
So in my personal journey, without faith, without tapping into a spiritual base and of source, I could not have gotten through the journey. It was very, very difficult. It was extremely stressful. And it was over a 15-year journey. And so with a lot of incredible challenges, like I said, I didn't know it at the time, but it really was a training ground for the work that I do every single day. As I support other families, I truly have come to understand that there is something so intrinsic within you that you have to be willing to give of yourself in order to care for a loved one from whatever the stage of diagnosis is until they take their final breath. That really is, it really forces you to tap into a spiritual source. And I really am a respecter of all religions, and whatever that spiritual source is for you, I just invite you to tap into it, because it is something greater than yourself that's needed to get through the journey and to survive the journey.
Hmm. What do you say to those who may not have a faith to draw support from? Where would they go?
I invite them to really read some of the selections and prayers in my gumbo, because it is a cross-section of people from all different walks and all different faiths. And what they've all come to understand during their caregiving journey is that it is something greater than themselves that they have to tap into, that they are forced to tap into in order to support their loved one and to be full and whole and at peace within themselves as they support their loved one on the journey. So that would certainly be a recommendation, but really I often get into conversations with individuals who say that, you know, they don't have a spiritual source, or that they don't believe. And I ask them, the questions that I ask them, what matters to them? Right. And we may call it, some of us have a name for it. Some of us call it God. Some of us call it Allah, you know, whatever the title is, or whatever, whether it's a universal being, whatever it is that you refer to it as, the recognition that there's something greater than yourself is really kind of an invitation that you are extended in this journey, because of course we're dealing with life and death issues, and we are really dealing with our purpose. And when we dive into those things, Scott, it forces us to go deeper and to really seek answers for ourselves.
And I think we'll leave it there. The books are Tears in My Gumbo and Prayers in My Gumbo. Both guides to dealing with the journey and the joy of caregiving. Thanks to you, Nadine, and much success in your work.
Thank you so much, Scott, for having me.
And that's our show. Thanks to our guests, and thanks to you for watching Studio Sacramento. I'm Scott Syphax. See you next time right here on KVIE.
Thank you for listening to Studio Sacramento from KVIE Public Television. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes to help others find it.
All episodes of Studio Sacramento, along with other KVIE programs, are available to watch online at kvie.org/video.